The Shasta and Scott TMDL waiver renewals, we're going to take them both, and we're going to open them beginning, we're going to open them both at the same time.
Oh, okay.
Because they are sister watersheds, they have great similarity in approach and in some of the outcomes here. What I would like to propose is that we open them both. We have a joint presentation that separates them, but yet it starts out the same. We will then take comments and differentiate the Shasta River first and then the Scott River following some of our opening presentation. So bear with me for one moment, please. This is a time and place for hearing the California Regional Water Quality Control Board North Coast Region and consider the adoption of R1-2012-0083 Shasta River TMDL conditional waiver of waste discharge requirements for discharges related to specific land management activities in the Shasta River watershed. Order number R12006-0052. This item has been properly noticed. Will all those who expect to give testimony please stand, raise your right hand, and take the following oath. Will you swear and affirm that you will tell the truth in this matter?
Yes.
Okay. And again, bear with me. We're going to do the same thing. This is a time and place for hearing of the California Regional Water Quality Control Board North Coast Region to consider adoption of order number R1-2012-0084, Scott River TMDL conditional waiver of waste discharge requirements. This item has been properly noticed. Will all those who expect to give testimony in this matter please stand, raise your right hand, and take the following oath. Do you swear and affirm to tell the truth in this matter?
Yes.
Yes.
Great. Okay, so again, what we're going to do is have staff open both items in presentation, and we will then differentiate from the Shasta River first from there. Good morning.
Good morning, Chairman Borman, Norman, and members of the board. We're going to present a joint presentation on both items 3 and 4, as you said, the Shasta TMDL conditional waiver, and then the Scott River TMDL conditional waiver. So we're going to take 3 first, Shasta River TMDL waiver, followed by the Scott River TMDL waiver, and then Brian's going to talk about implementation of the Scott and Shasta TMDL waivers. So moving ahead with Order 3, R1-2012-083, the Shasta waiver. Here's an outline of our presentations. We'll give a summary of the existing Shasta TMDL action plan and waiver program, followed by a summary of the new proposed Shasta River TMD waiver and our new approach to implementation. We'll talk a little bit about the public comments received on the draft, and then we'll give you our staff recommendations. So we're going to take a more balanced approach. The Regional Water Board will no longer require the submission of notice of intents from all responsible parties. We're not going to send out hundreds of letters requiring people to report and send in notice of intent to comply with the provisions of the TMDL. This approach didn't prove to be very fruitful over the first 5 years. So instead, we're going to focus on high priority habitat, utilizing site-specific approach that we will talk about later in the presentation. So we believe these efforts will result in more comprehensive water quality assessment and protection. So a brief summary of the Shasta River TMDL action plan. It's listed for dissolved oxygen and thank you. It's listed for dissolved oxygen and temperature. It contains an analysis and the implementation implementation plan identifies action necessary to achieve TMDL and water quality objectives. Parties will no longer be responsible for implementing the identified actions, and it re- requires monitoring and reporting. One of the good things about the...
Hey, Andy, can I back up? Can you say that again? Parties are not responsible? That's actually, I think, not correct. Parties are responsible for implementing the identified actions.
Oh, I'm sorry. Parties are responsible for implementing the identified actions and also required to do some monitoring and reporting. So the TMDL contains a provision conditionally waiving the requirements to file a report of waste discharge and obtain a waste discharge requirement for responsible parties that participate either individually or in ongoing collaborative programs and implement acceptable management practices like limiting their TMDL and protecting the riparian. So in other words, they're not no longer going to be required, or they won't be required to get a permit. So in summary, the proposed Shasta River TMDL waiver contains, as long as landowners employ land stewardship practices that minimize control and preferably prevent the discharge of TMDL pollutants, they're covered in the TMDL. And they won't be required to report to us. We also have a provision that allows staff reasonable access to property to evaluate compliance. And this hasn't been an issue in the past, so we don't expect it to be a big issue in the future. Also, submit plans and or other documentation only if required by the executive officer. So our approach to identifying and working in high priority risk settings, our initial focus efforts will be on identified cold water refugia and cold coho habitat areas downstream of Dwinnell Dam, Big Springs Creek, and Parks Creek. Then we'll gradually move downstream over time rather than requiring parties to enroll in the waiver all at once. We're going to use existing information like the coho emergency protection recommendations that identified fencing and riparian restoration needs. We'll use the tailwater reduction report to help identify tailwater discharge locations as well. So this is a map of the Shasta River watershed. And here's the top of Mount Shasta right there. And the river flows here. Here's Lake Shastina and down or up north to the Klamath River right there. So we're probably right about in there. So here's our priority areas that we're identifying. And in the next slide, you'll see more detail on priority area one. It's the area with cold water refugia for coho, and it's downstream of Lake Shastina. It includes the Big Springs complex, where there's a lot of cold water, a lot of springs. Parts of Parks Creek, and you'll see more detail on that in the next slide. Priority area number two is downstream of priority area, priority one is downstream of. Calm down.
Okay.
Priority area two is downstream of priority one. And the way we're going to implement this is we're going to work from upstream to downstream, hopefully getting clean cold water in priority one, and that'll assist in improving water quality in area two. Priority area three is Little Shasta River, which has some very good habitat for salmonids, but one of the problems is that fish migration is blocked due to low flows, And fish migration is one of the beneficial uses that is listed in our basin plan. So we want to open up this habitat, very good habitat, because at present it's not really being utilized to any great extent by fish. So priority number four, there's two areas. The bottom one is upstream of Lake Shastina, where there are no anadromous fish at this time. So we'll be working on that later. And then priority four is the canyon area, where there's not a whole lot of activity. Although we have gotten a couple of complaints that we had to respond to down there. So we're hoping that by cleaning up the upper river, that'll help improve water quality in area four down at the mouth of the Klamath, also known as Salmon Heaven. So this is a map of priority area one, and here's Lake Shastina, and here's the river. And if you look closely, you can see the red areas are areas that were not fenced in 2011, and the green areas, here's Big Springs Creek in here, a number of springs and coho, good coho habitat. But this is one of our success stories. In the last few years, almost all of this area has been protected or fenced, and there's a remarkable recovery that's happening very rapidly. I think the board's seen some of those presentations during past workshops on Big Springs Creek and TNC property. This is also happening on other landowners' property. There's just a handful of landowners that are working to eliminate tailwater and getting their property fenced. So I just want to point this out as, you know, priority area one has been priority area one, and we've had a lot of success just in the last few years, thanks to landowners. So in summary of the proposed Shasta TMDL waiver requirements for areas of high restoration, the executive officer can request ranch and tailwater management plans, and they can range from simple to comprehensive, and Brian's going to talk a little bit more about that. And we do have resources. There are resources available that are provided through 319 and other contract money that we administer to provide assistance in developing these ranch and tailwater management plans. And these plans, we don't expect the, they have they have private information in them, and we don't expect them to come off the ranches. These are for the ranchers to use. You know, they're for their own use to help them protect water quality, improve water quality conditions on their ranches. The executive officer can also require monitoring and reporting plans, and they could range from simple photo documentation or implementation measures. I'm sorry, I'm tongue-tied today.
You're doing fine.
To collect tailwater data for tailwater discharge characterization that can include an estimate of the volume and recording water temperatures from the tailwater discharge point into the river. Oh, and again, there are resources to assist landowners in doing the monitoring efforts as well. So finally, a summary of the proposed Shasta River TMDL waiver program. It extends the existing waiver provisions for another 5 years, and it recognizes progress made over the last 5 years, requires preparation of annual summaries and ranch plans only if requested by the executive officer. It allows Regional Water Board staff property access for quality for water quality assessment purposes, and focuses staff efforts in high priority areas. So here are some of the issues that were identified during the public comment period. I don't need to go over these because Brian's going to be talking about these in later on at the end of the presentation. So these are just some of the, or most all of our comments that we received.
If I can just elaborate on that, Matt St. John. So we received a number of comments during the public comment period, both written and as well as oral. And this slide summarizes those key themes in those public comment period. Many of them had to do with questions about how we're assessing risk to water quality, and then most importantly, how staff is going to be spending our time in order to implement this waiver. And so what we've done is spent, as you'll see, the kind of the third part of this presentation is largely walking through staff's implementation approach. And so this is kind of a heads up of those issues, and then the third part of the presentation will walk through the responses to those questions.
Thanks, Matt. Also, you know, I want to point out that we didn't make any great changes to the waiver. The past waiver is pretty close to the proposed waiver, except for these few changes that we're mentioning.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Baker on the information he just presented from board members?
Mr. Chair? Not so much a question for Mr. Baker, but I had hoped to do this before you got started, Andy, and you went so quick, David, that you got past me.
Just trying to be efficient.
Ms. Olson, could you give us a thumbnail sketch, if you will, of why we are here in terms of Clean Water Act and in terms of what we are doing as an overall picture of who does it and why we do it?
Well, in law school, we spent a good month on the Clean Water Act in environmental law 101. So it could get boring really quick. But I will say you have the Clean Water Act. That's federal legislation. And you also have the Porter-Cologne Water Quality Act. That's our state legislation for comprehensive control of water quality. And we implement the Clean Water Act through an agreement and approval by EPA. So that's what we do. We've had TMDLs promulgated in both the Scott and Shasta watersheds, which some of you were here for and some of you weren't. And the TMDL basically assigns allocations for discharges of waste in order to meet the water quality standards that are in our basin plan. And then meanwhile, the Porter-Cologne Act also requires the regulation of all discharges of waste regardless of an impaired listing under the Clean Water Act. And so we are the implementing agency for those laws. There are a number of avenues you could explore ad nauseum about various aspects of these laws. But I think the relevant point here is that we had the TMDLs adopted. We're looking at a waiver that gets now extended another 5 years to continue the approach that the board continue and refine the approach that the board approved 5 years previous.
Thank you. I think you hit the salient point for me. Because after the workshop that we did in early August here, and I think many of you were at that, I'm interested in making a point here, particularly for our staff and for the board, and that is that we are an implementing agency. We didn't dream this up. We're not the ones that do that. We are simply implementing the laws of the federal government and the state of California. And in that capacity, we tend to be, if you will, the best shot that any of us have at local control. I don't think you will ever see, in this case, six of us from the regional board. I doubt you will see six people from EPA. That isn't likely to happen. So we are here as, if you will, volunteers. As Mr. Moore pointed out, we are volunteers. And in that capacity, we are interested in making this as equitable and as easy as is possible. And that is true for not only us as board members, but also as a staff. And I think the thing that's really important about the voluntarism, if you will, of this board is that unlike regulators, we come from the citizenry. We are citizens of the region. We live, work, etc. in the region. We are part of this region. And in that process, we come from the citizenry. We will return to the citizenry at some point. So we are all very aware of the pain that we may or may not inflict. And that is different than anyone who is a professional regulator, particularly if you talk about the federal level. They do not live here. They don't work here. They may have very good professional judgment, but the fact is we are volunteers. We are the hope of, if you will, local control. And so in that sense, because this is a waiver from that TMDL, I'm hopeful that we can all understand why we do what we do and why this waiver is as hands-off as it possibly can be. And with that, I'll get off my soapbox.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. So any other questions? Thank you for that, Mr. Massey. That's very good. Any other questions or comments on what Andy's presented?
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I believe Brian's next. He's going to start the process on the Scott.
Thank you, Chairman Norman. Norin, what's going around?
It's contagious.
For the record, Brian McFadden of your staff. And my presentation today is going to cover a few topics. I'm first going to summarize the TMDL action plan for the Scott and what's in the existing waiver. I'll also talk about what's proposed to be different in the waiver that's in front of you today. And then I'll talk about our approach to implementing the waiver, and actually in two parts, as was alluded to in the beginning of the presentation. First part's going to be specific to the Scott, and then I'll go on to talk about some aspects of implementing the waiver that are common to both of these watersheds and waivers. So, as background, the Scott River TMDL Action Plan includes a summary of the temperature and sediment TMDL analyses that were conducted. It also contains an implementation plan that identifies actions that are necessary to achieve the TMDL and water quality objectives, and it does this by topic. An example of a topic are discharge of sediment from roads, for example. It also identifies parties that are responsible for implementing the identified action. And this is by category. So an example of a category is responsible or parties responsible for the maintenance of roads. It corresponds to the road sediment topic. The TMDL action plan, and I'll note that it's also incorporated into our basin plan, has provisions that that allow for the executive officer to request and receive grazing and riparian management plans as well as erosion control plans, also monitoring and reporting plans. But again, it's those are to be provided if requested by the executive officer. So that's in the action plan. Currently, that's part of our basin plan and is current regulatory language. Now I'll shift the focus to what's in the existing Scott River conditional waiver. It's pretty simple. The conditions for qualifying for the waiver are participation in and the implementation of the TMDL and control of those TMDL pollutants, in a nutshell. There's another element of a condition of the waiver, which is the condition that allows regional board staff access to private property for the purposes of observing, inspecting, collecting samples, monitoring compliance or noncompliance with the action plan. I'd point out that this is a pretty standard term in our waivers. The waiver is a regulatory document, and it sort of relies on our ability to verify that the conditions are met. So before I move on to what's proposed for the next generation of this waiver, I want to talk about some of the challenges that we've had in the previous in the implementation of the previous waiver. And those have a lot to do with communication and transparency. The existing action plan and waiver don't contain a formal mechanism for reporting water quality protection on a larger scale. And that includes both the status of water quality protection. You know, I've been working in the Scott for a while. I know that there exists a range of conditions on these properties that includes properties that are exemplary properties for protection of water quality. And on the other range, there are properties that need some attention to address water quality issues. And a lot of people in between. And the existing approach didn't give us a tool for quantifying how much protection exists and what that status is, as well as the needs that are out there for implementing the TMDL and correcting any water quality aspect that needs correcting. Another challenge has been that it has just been dialogue. And, you know, the farm and ranch operators in Scott Valley are very busy people. They're working hard to put food on their tables, and the nature of the work requires that they work long hours. And so it's been difficult to reach out to that community through public meetings, and that's been a challenge. And finally, there's been a lot of questions about the specifics of implementing the action plan and what that means on the ground and on particular properties. So these are the challenges that we were thinking of when we crafted this next version of the waiver, and I think that, well, I hope that you'll agree that the new approach addresses these things and gives us a sound approach to implementing the TMDL. So moving on to the new contents, we've taken those action plan requirements for the submittal of plans, both grazing and riparian management and erosion control plans, as well as monitoring plans, and included those into the waiver. And again, it's upon the request of the Regional Water Board Executive Officer. So this is just taking something that's in the action plan and now putting it in the waiver. We've also included some explicit guidance on management measures that control the discharge of the pollutants that are of concern. And I'll just read off a couple of these. Riparian areas are managed in a manner that allows sufficient vegetation to prevent increased surface erosion. Livestock are removed from riparian areas when stubble height reaches 4 inches or livestock shift preference to browsing of woody species, whichever occurs first. Those are just two examples, and they're guidance in this waiver. They're not requirements. The intent is that we want to be clear about what implementing the TMDL means There's also an acknowledgement that that monitoring, if it's required, may include a range of types of monitoring and specificity, and it can range from simple to complex, depending on the site-specific characteristics. And I kind of breezed through that because I'm going to talk more about it in a moment. So to summarize, the proposed waiver in front of you has three conditions that landowners need to meet in order to attain coverage. The first condition applies to all landowners, and that's to employ the practices that control the discharge of the TMDL pollutants of concern. The next two requirements are only requirements if the Regional Board Executive Officer requests access to property, and the providing of plans or other documentation. So the first is applies to everybody. The second two are depending on the situation. So we had a number of comments submitted by the public, and those comments are addressed and responded to in the response to comments document and in the executive officer's summary report. But the two that I want to talk more about in my presentation are and had a lot of comments submitted, the majority of the comments submitted address these two points. That is the criteria by which we'll prioritize our efforts to implement and how we'll evaluate risk to water quality. Those are just going hand in hand. And the criteria, basically, when are we going to require the development of a plan? Or in staff's case, when are we going to recommend to the executive officer that those plans be requested? So I'm going to address the first one now. The second one I'm going to wait into the second part of the presentation, and because it really applies to both these watersheds. So in regard to evaluating risk and how we are going to prioritize our efforts, the risk, as we're defining it, is pretty simple. It's based on the existence. Well, let me back up. I'm getting ahead of myself. So we're going to evaluate risk on a property by property basis, and we'll assess the water quality protection in that manner. We've identified a subset of properties that pose the higher risk, and I want to explain that now. As I was starting to say, it's pretty simple. It's based on farming and ranching activities adjacent to waters of the state. So it's the co-location of those two things. If those activities are occurring away from waters of the state, and we're talking about Scott River and its tributaries, then we don't think that's as high a risk. So it's a pretty simple concept. And our prioritization is also pretty simple, I'd say also. It's based on the length of those farming and ranching activities adjacent to the streams. So we'll start with the operators who manage the greatest length of property adjacent to those streams who are engaged in farming and ranching activities. And I have a slide that I think will explain why we think this is a good approach. So we did a little analysis and looked at properties and where they lie in relation to streams and the length of streams associated with each property. And what stood out to us is that by addressing the 15 largest landowners, we're going to be addressing half the length of the streams in Scott Valley adjacent to these activities. So that represents some efficiency. And similarly, if we approach 96 of these properties and go through our process, we're addressing 90% of the stream length. So we think this is a good template for making sure that our efforts are efficient, and also a good template for being able to report the progress and status of our activities. You know, we can come back to you and explain to you where we are on this line. And so that represents my summary of the Scott TMDL specific aspects of implementation in this waiver. And just to give you a heads up, I'm going to be talking about when we might recommend a plan, how we'll approach landowners, and the things that we're going to be looking at in terms of our concerns about water quality. So I'll present that ahead, but I would like to entertain any questions you might have about what I presented so far.
Any comments or questions from the board for Mr. McFadden on the Scott River?
That was the major take-home message from the workshops attending was where you're about to go with this. So with that, I'd say go for it.
Okay. Okay, so I just remind everyone that this does apply to both the Scott and the Shasta. So in regards to where we're going to focus our efforts, Andy presented priority areas for the Shasta River, and I presented our approach for working through the waiver in the Scott. And so that's, of course, one of the criteria by which we're going to focus our efforts. But we'll also be addressing water quality issues that come to our attention through the complaint process. And then we have here areas with unique opportunities to improve water quality identified. And what we're thinking there is that we want to make sure that we're allowing ourselves the opportunity to work when opportunities come up. Those might be a project in which a group of landowners or another agency takes the initiative to improve water quality, and it may not have been high on our list, but that's an opportunity for us to engage landowners and talk about water quality protection and verify that the TMDL is met in those areas. So that's what that's about. In regards to how we'll approach landowners and go about the nuts and bolts of contacting landowners, we typically do that by phone, having to come from outside the watershed to arrange these. And so a landowner might get a phone call from us asking to come out to their property, and we would find a time that works for both of us. And at the time that we come out to the property, we would first begin with reviewing and discussing the elements of the conditional waiver that applies, and move on to assessing management practices and water quality protection measures, and continue to discuss those aspects in relation to the program requirements. And if applicable, we'll talk about assistance programs that can help. If appropriate, we'd identify areas that need improvement, and also areas that where the practices are working, and discuss that with the landowners. And at that point, either verify that water quality is being protected and follow up with a letter stating that, or identify the things that remain to be done to protect water quality, whichever is appropriate. Now, in regards to what we're going to be paying attention to when we're assessing compliance, we'll do that and assess the need for plans or any monitoring on a case-by-case basis. There's not a blanket requirement here, and we're going to do that using a consistent approach. Of course, we're interested in nutrients in the case of the Shasta, and sediment in the case of the Scott, and temperature in both cases. And so we'll be focusing our assessments on things related to riparian condition, livestock access to riparian areas, and the degree that management measures allow the operators to control that. Of course, potential discharge of eroded sediments. We'll be paying, looking for that. And then also tailwater discharge and the potential for that. That's a pretty good summary of our concerns and what we'll be looking for. We may recommend to the executive officer that the executive officer request a plan or other kind of documentation. When I say other documentation, it could be monitoring, or it could be some sort of completion report that doesn't involve doing something in the future, but saying, "Yes, I've done this." So we identify other documentation because it's not always going to be in a plan, but we'll recommend the request of these plans or other documentation if corrective actions are complex and it really is going to involve some expertise, or if the level of effort to control the discharges or discharge is great, it may be a relatively simple solution that involves heavy machinery or something, and I would say the level of effort is great in that kind of situation. And finally, if we're unable to come to an agreement with the landowner or operator at the time of inspection, and that may be because for a number of reasons, it could be that simply there's not agreement in terms of what a staff might identify as some possible solutions, or the solution isn't real clear, and the landowner's going to need to put some thought into that and get back to us. Now, both Andy and I mentioned that the scope of plans can span a broad range, and it's going to depend on the site-specific conditions. It will also be something that we specify in writing, so there's not ambiguity or misunderstanding. It could be a very simple plan that meets the need. Just a simple description of practices could be done on a single sheet of paper. I think actually that's the side of the spectrum that most of our requests are going to the area that we're going to be in. But in some cases, there's going to be the need for a more comprehensive plan that involves inventory of sources and a map, schedule, description of practices to control the source, and a monitoring and reporting program. That's more typical of, say, like an erosion control plan that. That we would request in other situations, like timber harvest, for instance. Now, I want to point out that in the future, we may have an opportunity for landowners to obtain assistance. through the Klamath Tracking and Accounting Program. It's a program that's still in development, but it holds promise, great promise, I would say, and it could result in assistance with any of the following: monitoring, crediting and certification, third-party certification, assistance with obtaining funding or developing plans or identifying priorities. So in summary, I think what we've come up with is a balanced approach that that addresses some of the challenges that I identified. It also is responsive to the community. About a year and a half ago, we had our first workshop on this topic in Scott Valley. And we heard real clearly that landowners didn't want a one-size-fits-all program that requires that has blanket requirements for people to submit paperwork whether or not there's an issue. So this approach utilizes that case-by-case analysis to get around that while still achieving a comprehensive program for water quality assessment and protection. And you know, crafting these things is always a balancing act, and we think we've done a credible job in finding that balance. And so we're recommending to you the adoption of both of these waivers, the Shasta TMDL waiver of waste discharge requirements and the Scott TMDL waiver of waste discharge requirements. And I'll leave our contact information up for the public.
Brian, thank you. Thank you, too, Andy. Just to be clear, too, the last part of your presentation is a common theme, though, between these watersheds, correct? You've, in essence, lined these approaches in parallel based on not only the unique characters of these watersheds, but the fact that they are sister watersheds, and they do have similarities. They have similar land use components to them. It looks like you recognize the differences, but yet you see the common approach being of benefit here.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. You know, in the Shasta, there's a little more obvious basis for prioritizing our efforts. There's some really unique areas with potential for restoration and cold water sources. And it's not quite the same for the Scott, so there's an example of where a slightly different approach makes sense. But, yeah, I agree with what you're saying. Yeah.
I wanted to make a general statement, too. I know you start to do this just to talk about kind of, you know, the work that's been done here. And I want to actually acknowledge this community. There's 5 years of work that's been done here, not only by this agency but by this community at large. This TMDL action plan has been in place for 5 years. It's been in play. There's been quite a lot of work in both of these watersheds that has gone on by landowners, interested parties, participating agencies and groups. And I want to recognize that. I want to recognize the work that's been done. I know there's been a significant amount of fencing done out here. There's been some abandonment of old diversions out here. There's been tailwater work over on this side of the hill in the Shasta. There's been the groundwater study over in the Scott. So there's been quite a lot of work that's been done out here, and I want to call that out. I do like the fact that there's a prioritization basis here, that there is, after 5 years, to me, we benefit from the point of hindsight and foresight at the same time, recognizing what's been done, but also recognizing going forward and how, what, when, and where this is going to happen from here. The one thing I would just ask as a reminder, and I know we haven't had public comment, but as a premise, that these conditional waivers are conditional to everybody in the watershed. Well, and this is a question, too, in that my premise is, and the way that I understand these TMDLs and the waivers that are in play now, is that everybody's in. The conditions are conditional to meet the waiver, and if you conditionally meet that, then you're in. While this work now, in the next 5 years, will work with the entire watershed, it does prioritize the basis based on these criteria that you've identified here. So it's, I believe, and it's not really a question, really, but I guess it is an acknowledgement, right, that everybody's in here. Everybody's in this conditional waiver, in this watershed.
I would only caveat that by saying that some landowners in these watersheds are covered by other regulatory processes. And so
correct,
everybody who's not already covered by one of those processes,
correct,
is in.
Okay. Thank you for that, by the way. and that using this risk-based assessment and approach, I think, is good. I think it's fair at this point to get at some of the specifics and leave some of the things on the side that didn't work, recognizing that some of this didn't work. And I think that's also a fair and honest assessment at this point. Also recognizing that the TMDL action plans, both these TMDL have action plans that are inked into our basin plan, and those stand. That is a premise from which we operate on. This adds a second layer of approach, and to me, this gets to the implementation side. It doesn't necessarily change the waiver as a legal mechanism, but it really does get to that approach side. And I think it's good that staff at this point are being more explicit and heard some of these comments about approach and implementation approach. I think that's very good. Any other comments or questions from board members?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hepp.
I appreciate the approach in terms of the efficiency and the prioritization. I think that's a good way to do it. I think it's largely in response to the comments that you've received at your workshops and throughout this process. You did make a note, though, one of the other triggers for an evaluation could be from a complaint. And I'm curious, I think it was brought up at the last workshop about potential abuse of a complaint process, and not that I'm looking for an answer on how we deal with that, more just an acknowledgement that we are aware of that and that it's on our radar screen, that's something that we definitely need to pay attention to, because if that's, you know, it could be a problem. So we want to make sure that that's either of you, somebody, I see heads nodding. I'm getting the impression that yes, we are perhaps keeping a log of that. Or,
well, you know, I've been doing this for 26 years, working with landowners, responding to public complaints, and we find that there's a lot of times where the complaints we're getting from citizens or agencies, mostly citizens, agencies are a little better, I think, but they don't have much validity. Or we don't agree with them. Or, you know, it may be a feud between two neighbors. So we're really good about sorting that out, prioritizing, well, is this a bad problem? Does it need immediate attention? Or can we just work with the landowner and come up with an agreement, just verbal between the two of us or whoever? So I don't see it as a big problem with us sorting all that out.
Great. Thanks.
Can I just add to that?
Yep.
So this is Matt St. John. So we do have a complaint tracking database. So every complaint that we get in, we log in. We have a process for documenting how staff have followed up on that and what kind of resolution there is, whether there was a need for some kind of assessment or whether we just made a phone call and resolved it that way. But so we do have a tracking system for dealing with complaints like that.
Thanks.
I have a couple of questions.
This is Samantha Wilson, your counsel. Just to add on the complaint issue, I was not successful in finding formal causes of action for abuse of process in this regard. We're an administrative agency. False Claims Act requires a person making a false complaint to be getting money or some sort of property by virtue of the false claims. So I did commit at the workshop to researching the law on this, and I haven't made much progress, but I think the log would be sufficient if an issue of, you know, somebody filing too many complaints and they were false came up. I think the remedy is you lose credibility with the agency. And so we'll have a log of that. I'll keep looking, and I'm, you know, somebody know something more than me, but I was not successful to find, you know, something, because it's all administrative anyway. It's not like a complaint gets filed and somebody gets locked up because of the complaint.
Well, and by the way, I just want to acknowledge that that was a question that was posed to you at the Scott Valley workshop, I believe, and I appreciate you actually coming and circling back around, Sam, and answering that. Ms. Harris, did you have some questions?
Just a couple. I just wanted to just have some clarity in my own thought here. When on page 5, where it says grazing within the riparian corridors occurs for short... Oh, no, wait, let me go up here. Grazing in the riparian areas is late winter, early spring, when impacts to woody species are minimized. Well, late winter to early spring is probably when we got high water running through there, so I don't think a lot of folks are going to stick livestock in those areas at that time. So that's kind of a, we're not really saying no, but we're just saying you can do it when it's probably not one of the better times to do it. That's just a thought that goes through my mind. And then also, Brian, can you tell me where we got the 4 inches on the stubble height reaches 4 inches? And is that on perennials or annuals, or is that for both? Or
I got that from a paper. I'm forgetting the name of the researcher, but it was a paper that that described and documented that that cows change their preference at a point where you know, basically they go from bringing in the grass with their tongue to using their lips,
mm-hmm.
and at that point the palatability of willows becomes greater than stubble.
Okay.
So that was the basis.
Okay. And then also, just for so the audience knows, I'm a range scientist, so I always like to know a little bit more about these kinds of things, and I always try my hardest to think of things from the perspective of the landowner and how innately and intuitively, after years and years of land management, when someone comes in and says, can you write down what you do, you think to yourself, well, sure, but then when you go to set down, there's so many variables in what you do and why you do it, and the time of the year and the way that the grass is growing and the management of your operation and when it's time to calve and when it's time to ship, and all that stuff plays in to the weather and everything else. It's kind of difficult to write down when I do things and why I do them. Sometimes you have a plan and you walk through the pasture, and that day that plan is immediately changed, and off you go into a different field, or the neighbor's cows bust in, or the bulls get in a fight and tear that fence out. So there's a million variables, and one of my concerns when we are going to be going into these properties with permission, and we're going to be looking at these landscapes with the landowners who walk and work these lands on a regular basis, it's going to maybe be a broad learning curve for some to be able to understand how land management and livestock operations work. And it may take more than one visit to come to that conclusion as to, well, that's why he did that on that specific day, or that's why that landowner chose to run those cattle in there, you know, for a lightning quick graze through, because this was happening on the other side of the property. And it's important that when we go onto these properties and we're looking at the way people manage them and hoping to improve water quality through best management practices, that we also remember that this is a business and an operation. And it's important to remember, too, that if they don't grow grass, they don't grow net daily gains. And without those net daily gains, those animals are not shipped at a profit. So we have to keep in all of those things in our mindset when we walk through the properties and give the folks the opportunity to explain their management practices thoroughly and then come back and remember, well, you know, that specific day you were there, this was happening too. And to make sure that we're looking at these properties with the full understanding of the management and how it works. And then we all need to always remember that without clean water, we have, our existence isn't, you know. I don't think all of us want to go back to the Renaissance era where you could only drink beer every day. Some of us might, but, and so it's important to keep our waters clean. And I know that, like we mentioned at the beginning, we all have the ultimate goal of making sure that the law is being met. And we can go at it from a narrow perspective, or we can go at it from a wide perspective. And I think the larger playbook is better for everybody. But we do need to remember that the ultimate intent is clean water. So I know you're probably going to be the boots on the ground out there. And I know you've been doing it for a long time, and I know your background. So I just, kudos to your efforts, and I would encourage you to really take the time to get your feet dirty and to spend time on the properties and looking at them and having a full understanding of their management and the requirements of them in their daily life.
You're always so well spoken.
Thanks.
Yes, sir.
I agree with what you're saying, and I think one thing that's represented here is an understanding that, that we need to work with landowners on an individual basis. And that's, you know, we're not going to avoid that. We need to have those conversations and respect the variability out there on the landscape in terms of the situations that people are dealing with and the way they handle that, and that a blanket approach isn't really going to get us there. And so I think what we're proposing is in line with what you just said.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Mr. Baker?
One thing I didn't emphasize, on the Shasta, we do plan to have more boots on the ground, more time on the ground. That's going to make a big difference, you know, because I'm moving to the county, and I'll, you know, I'm only 20 minutes from priority area one. So.
Well, one other thing, an aside here too, because it got brought up earlier, actually Steve Moore brought it up on the state board, is that I want to also reiterate the fact these two waivers are a no-fee program at this point, which I think is a very important point. The fee-based world seems to be, you know, obviously Steve talked about that and how that's going. These are both no-fee programs, which I think is important. I think it's important to recognize the efforts of these landowners and accomplishments where we can, and to try our hardest as a board to keep this a no-fee program. So with that, what I'd like to do is let you gentlemen take a seat for a minute, and thank you for that. And then what I'd like to do is bring up comments on the Shasta. So what we'd like to do from here is go through comments on the Shasta side. Now, I have speaker cards that both indicated either an agenda item 3 or 4 or 3 and 4. So if I call you and you would like to make your comments specific to the Scott, we will do the same. We're going to do this twice. The first person actually I'd like to call is Marcia Armstrong. Marcia, you marked agenda item 4, but I don't know if you wanted to speak on 3, but I